Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Once a month, Mayor Vi Lyles is on the program. She's with us this hour, just as council finds itself drawing voting district maps based on the 2020 census, and just before discussions begin about the Unified Development Ordinance. We'll talk about both those things, along with the upcoming electrification of the city's buses, the county's non-discrimination ordinance, the entertainment district, and more. Mayor, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me back, Mike. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Good morning to everyone that's listening today.
On August 23rd, the City Council began the process of deciding how to redraw voting districts based on the 2020 census. They have to do this once every 10 years, and they have to be finished by November the 17th when they hand those maps over to the Elections Board. Where are they in the process right now?
Well, we have a recommendation from an ad hoc committee of the council that has three maps that are coming in and that are published on our website. You can look at them on redistricting at charlottenc.gov. But more importantly, we have a public hearing that's required by law that is going to be held this Monday. And when our building opens for public attendance at our council meetings on this Monday, with social distancing and masks required. So people will be able to come in and talk about these maps. You know, when we started out on this process, there were primarily three interested parties. There was the party, the League of Women Voters, always engaged in the idea of making sure that we avoid gerrymandering and some of those things that have happened in the past. The next groups are the two political parties. But for me, when you only draw your lines every 10 years, I really would like to see the public come in and engage with us on this because it's so very important. You can change the form of government, but you have to do that through a very long process of referendum and citizen voting. So this is the one time that elected officials have to adjust because of the census. And that October 8th public hearing is going to be important, but it's more important that if you have an idea and can't make it, please send in your information to redistricting at charlottenc.gov.
You mentioned the ad hoc committee that's in charge of drawing these maps or proposing these maps to the full council. And that committee consists of Malcolm Graham, who's the chairman, Ed Driggs, Dimple Ashmira, and Greg Phipps. That's three Democrats and one Republican. You chose the members. How did you choose those people?
Well, one, Malcolm was around for the last redistricting. So having that experience both at the local level and when he was in the state Senate was important because a lot of this there's a lot of details to what's required to meet the requirements that we have under the legal system. So I thought his experience would be good. I also know that as you look at what we have in our community, our council is, this city is a blue city in a red state. But I also feel it's really important to have the Republicans represented. So to have Dimple Ashmira, who is a Democrat, Greg Phipps is a Democrat, but I also thought he would bring an objectivity to this process because he has no stake in it. No matter what happens, he has decided he is not running for a public office. So his term ends with this. And then Ed Driggs represents the southern part of this community, which votes Republican, even though it might be registered Republican and unaffiliated. He represents that. So I thought it was a good balance of experience, proportionality, and party politics. What I failed to really kind of understand is that there's always some inherent idea of oversight by the North Carolina state legislature. While we are a blue state, a blue city and a red state, the Republicans in our community have a lot of access to the state level Republican officers. And so in other communities, we should have, or can and will pay attention to the idea of what's acceptable when you have the number of Democrats that we have and proven by the registration numbers but also maintaining a voice for the Republican Party in a way that doesn't endanger or threaten the balance of the state potential to come in and design our own districts as they've done in other communities.
The committee looking at this approved the criteria for drawing up these new districts back in June. They have to have substantially equal populations, each district. They should be reasonably compact and follow neighborhood boundaries as closely as possible. And then they removed two criteria dealing with partisan balance, because based on population numbers, it would be nearly impossible to achieve partisan balance. What does that mean? Is it there just not enough Republicans to have an equal number of Republicans and Democrats represented in each district?
I think that that removal was given because when you look at the actual numbers, you can see where the balance is of Democrats unaffiliated and Republican. You can see the numbers. They're there from all kinds of data sources. I think what happened was that it was became a lightning rod for some controversy that doesn't necessarily, in the end, it's a great soundbite, and it's intentionally thoughtful, I believe, because people wanted to make sure that there were going to be, the next steps would be impartial. I think the next steps are impartial. I think that it was just a moment of let's make sure that people understand there are two ways to look at this, and it just turned into more of a kerfuffle than I thought necessary.
So there are two Republicans on council. One of them is City Councilman Tariq Bukhari. He's already characterized some of Malcolm Graham's work on this project as gerrymandering. He says that when you scratch the surface, Graham is trying to remove yet another Republican seat. Graham's response to that is that the committee has been open and transparent and honest. What has Ed Driggs, the Republican who's actually on the committee, had to say about the process and how it might impact Republicans' chances of maintaining the two seats they have or picking up one or two elsewhere?
Well, I think that what Ed, Tark, and Malcolm would say is that we'd have one solid Republican district based upon the data, and that is District 7 that Ed is represents. I think that what you would see is as the community has grown and become more Democratic and unaffiliated, that it was almost impossible to do what we did in 1979 when districts were being created in a way that there was actually more of a balance between the political parties. And now what we have is obviously a situation where we're trying to create, using the data, the retention of neighborhood boundaries and neighborhood interest. There's a term for a community interest that makes sure that things are aligned. And that's what this has ended up being, more around how do you represent people that come to us, whether they're Republican, Democratic, or unaffiliated, to say that I have a different point of view. And the maps that are presented, at least one or I think all of the maps that are presented, have that opportunity to be successful. And council is looking for feedback from the community.
There are three maps, as you said. Map A, for lack of a better term, seems to be the least favorite for a variety of reasons. And B and C attempt to follow this directive of keeping communities of interest together. Define communities of interest.
So community of interest, and I'm not a lawyer and I'm not going to try to be one, but this is what our attorney, the people that have been guiding us in this process, it's where people have similar patterns and data around those patterns. So they generally live in an area where there's data that shows that this is a neighborhood. And the city has lots of neighborhood maps and boundaries to document that for the last 10 years. They also try to attempt to make sure that the voting, the numbers by law have to come down to be around 125,000 people in each district. So then when you're considering how District 4 and District 3 are rapidly growing and they're already over that amount, when you're trying to get them to decrease the numbers so that they can be consistent with the legal requirement, you want to do it not just by picking somebody on the north side and on the west side. You want to try to have a group of people that a precinct, perhaps, or a neighborhood that is going to be able to be moved and still feel that there is a relevance between what they do that impacts their lives in government.
The population of Charlotte in the last 10 years grew. This actually surprises me because I think the number sounds low. It grew by 140,000 people. I thought it would have been much higher than that. Of course, that's just the city. That's not the county.
Right.
And so today we have a population of nearly 875,000 people in the city of Charlotte. They're not talking about increasing the number of districts from 7 to 8 despite that growth. Is that because of the math, because they want to keep the districts at about 125,000 people per district?
No, I think that it's because when we had a commission of a committee, because, you know, it being someone that's involved in this and knows that it was going to be a real issue for making sure that we come out of it with consensus and the ability to live with a decision, we had a committee appointed, and we actually had Amy Peacock chaired it. We had people from all over the city participate in it, Republicans and Democrats, and they came up with a recommendation that was considered by the council. But so many things have occurred since they made their recommendation. They did recommend that we look at how big our districts are, whether or not we should go to 4-year terms. There were a number of governance issues that we as a community need to decide in the next several years, you know, whether or not the mayor's position should be full time, or how many years should we go to 4-year terms. All of those things were discussed. But the one that was adopted was the one around the redistricting parameters, and that's what we did. To go to an 8th district would mean that we would have to have another process in place, because to change how our districts are actually, the number of them, requires either the council to adopt something that's up for a referendum, or a referendum by the community to adopt something. In 79, when my good friend Ron Leeper was driving this effort, he basically got the signatures necessary by the citizens to come forward to redraw the districts. So that's one method. So we've got to, it's a little bit more complex to change what we are currently doing instead of just redistricting, which is the, I think, the requirement right now. The other requirements can come forward, but it does require a little bit more work.
I want to go back to something you said earlier in this conversation about not wanting the state to get involved as they have in other areas, you said. We are a Dillon rule state, which means the legislature is supreme. And many people don't understand, I suppose, that the legislature can, at their whim, dissolve municipalities. They could dissolve the city of Charlotte tomorrow if they chose to do so. So is it a legitimate concern to do things on the up and up with regard to redistricting, because you fear that the legislature might come in and reverse some things or change some things or say, nope, this is how it's going to be? Is that a legitimate concern?
Well, I'm mayor of Charlotte, so my job is to make sure Charlotte acts and provides the services to our citizens. I always know that we're a Dillon rule state. I always know that the state can come in and do all kinds of things. We've seen that happen. So my job is to make sure that there's always balance, that we continue to communicate with our legislators. And I have seeing that we've been able over the last 3 years to get some things accomplished that we would be sometimes questioned by. And so I think that we just keep working at good communication and collaboration with the legislature.
Charlotte Mayor Vial Lyles, our guest for the hour. When we come back, we'll talk about the next step that follows the 2040 plan, the UDO. Stay with us. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Charlotte Mayor Vial Lyles is with us, and we're about to talk about something that may become the focus of discussions for many months to come. Debates over the Charlotte 2040 Comprehensive Plan got pretty dicey earlier this year, and that plan finally passed through council on a very close vote, 6-5, after getting hung up on provisions that allow duplexes and triplexes to pop up now in neighborhoods that have been traditionally zoned for single-family homes. That plan is merely a set of guidelines without the force of law, and it will serve as a kind of aspirational document for what the council is about to discuss, the new unified development ordinances. If passed as prologue, Madam Mayor, will these discussions prove to be just as contentious?
You know, we had a really good meeting on Monday this week about the kind of things that we needed to do. And I saw a real change in the dialogue. It wasn't personal. It wasn't accusatory. It was really around the idea that we have the most important work we can do for this community that's going to really put in place how we look and how we grow. And that now we're able to actually look at assumptions. We have created an independent person that we have hired to do modeling, although I have to say that he may have to compete for his job with Councilmember Driggs, who did this for years professionally. But I think that what we learned that assumptions, we need to have lots of opportunity to discuss what is my assumption about growth? What is your assumption within the framework of that adopted plan? And I saw that in the council. I saw the participation, the questions being asked, that really are within the framework of what we adopted. This work wouldn't be going on if we continued to talk about what we might do. And I always try to focus on the fact that what is going on right now is not the thing that the council, I don't believe anyone in the council believes that our current growth and the way that we're growing so quickly is the appropriate growth that's going to be the kind of growth that keeps our city economically viable with its own culture and the ability to have great quality of life. So Monday night, we started talking about, here are the assumptions that the economists that we're working with model. But what are the assumptions that the council would like to see? So there are questions about, well, let's talk about the percentage of costing of affordability of housing versus diversity of housing. Talk about what we know is going on versus what the undeveloped properties, Mr. Newton, Mr. Bakari, Mr. Winston had about 10 questions, all about what we're trying to accomplish. So I think we're in a good place on our policy mapping. We also are continuing a really strong public engagement process beginning October 13th, which is today, is it? So we're starting today with community conversations in the afternoon and the evening. We had a survey of over 4,000 people, statistically valid survey of 4,000 people online. We are continuing to make sure that we discuss this thoroughly internally within the staff, the policymakers of the council members, as well as the public.
So we're not going to get into the weeds of what's in the Unified Development Ordinance, because I know that we'll do that in future programs as the discussions over this go on. But what they essentially are is a rewriting of and a consolidation of zoning rules that have been put in place piecemeal over the last, 30 years or so, and putting it together in one comprehensive plan that follows the guidelines that were set out in the 2040 Comprehensive Plan. But zoning, I don't care whether it's you're rezoning a playground into something else, whatever it is always controversial. From what you know of what's in this Unified Development Ordinance, where do you think the sticking points might be? Where will you spend the most time hashing it out?
Well, Mike, that's a great question. I wish I could say that I knew the sticking points, but I think we'll continue to focus on where people live is one, and how dense we will be. And allowing that kind of density and the density necessary as when I became mayor, the first in my first election, I used to say 60 people a day are moving here and they're bringing 6/10 of a car each. Now it's 120 people a day moving here and they're still bringing 6/10 of a car here. So the two issues that I think are the most sticking points are going to be How dense we do to create housing for people and choices of housing. And then how do we move people around the city, the transportation aspect, making full utilization of our existing rail, but also trying to determine how we can have adequate density for a reliable and affordable bus system aspire to have.
This is a little off topic, but since you brought up the idea of transportation, there's a major infrastructure bill in Congress right now that President Biden desperately wants passed. It's entirely in the hands of Democrats. The Republicans are not going to help at all. And the Democrats are in control, and yet they can't get their act together to pass a Kleenex around the room.
Heard that phrase, Mike.
I just made it up.
Kleenex around the room. Okay, I'm going to try to remember that one.
What would you say to the Democrats, because you're a Democrat, to the Democrats in Congress who have this once-in-a-generation opportunity, which we're going to talk about on this program tomorrow, to do these things and to put infrastructure money in place for cities like Charlotte to develop their transportation structure? What would you say to them?
I say everybody has to be able to live with it. That means you have to compromise, collaborate on this. We cannot let the continued erosion of our infrastructure in our major cities and our rural areas decline. We just can't do that as a country. And it's really difficult to have the country held hostage to debates around things that, you know, and this is really the crux of the issue. You know, do I want the slices of bread or do I want the whole loaf? And if you know me, my principles around being a Democrat is you have to keep moving forward. You just can't stop to get everything that's going to change the world. And I am a firm supporter of the president's initiatives. And I think that many of us need to make those speeches that we need to do everything, but we need to also get something done.
So what I'm hearing you say is a slice or a couple of slices is better than nothing at all. And that's what you stand to lose. You either, the people who want the whole loaf are liable to hold it up so that nothing comes down the pike. Is that what I'm hearing?
And this is a moment in time that we have to really do something that people can visibly see in this country. You know, we're a donor state to the federal government's transportation plans, and we're not getting what we need to get. So let's guys in Washington, if I would say something, I would say, please show people that the federal government works for communities like ours.
So getting back to the unified
states like ours.
So getting back to the Unified Development Ordinance, which led us down that track, this document supposedly the goal is to be user friendly, so that it clearly outlines expectations that the city will use as it continues to grow. But the darn thing is 608 pages, and it separates zoning into 11 different types with different standards. Is it really possible for this kind of a comprehensive plan to be user-friendly at the same time?
I think that the 600-plus pages are because you've consolidated everything that you've ever had. It's probably kind of like saying, and I say this a lot, when we create something new, that we get rid of the old. So what you've got in the 600 pages, everything from subdivisions, trees for stormwater, floodplain, at some point we'll have to make this a document that can be fully understood. But when you're just compiling everything that you've done over the last 30 or 40 years, it's going to be likely that most of us didn't realize how much redundancy or how many times we recreated something and left it in place just moving forward incrementally. And this is a time that we have the opportunity to make it better. And I think that it will be better and it'll be more engaging. And yes, we have complexities around zoning, but it's okay to have the district as long as the explanation is concise and to the point.
One thing I remember about conversations about the 2040 plan was finding a way to entice developers to include community benefits, and we talked about this months ago, into a project, and the UDO includes those incentives, including giving developers the chance to, the chance to earn bonuses and broaden development rights, whatever that means. There are several things proponents would like to see come of this. Is more affordable housing one of them?
I think that affordable housing is going to be with us for a very long time, just because the time that we did not take action on it. So affordable housing has to be a part of this plan. And there were some questions. I think Councilmember Driggs said, you know, we've had some bonuses, bonus programs, I think that was adopted when Anthony Fox was mayor here, and they've not been taken advantage of. So how do we go back to the people that do affordable housing? And I think that's the first step, is to talk to affordable housing developers to see what that we can do. And we have got some absolutely outstanding corporations or companies doing affordability housing. And I think that that's going to be the first step. But the bottom line, if it's not created to actually get the results that we want, we need to know it now, not necessarily by passing the law, the ordinance, and then waiting to see what happens. So we're going to engage with those affordable housing folks first, and then we'll continue to have the engagement throughout the development community.
I know the development community has already poured through this document, the 608-page document, but these conversations also require citizen input. I know that you want that. Where do people go, ordinary people go, to see this document and understand it so they can formulate questions if they have any of their own?
Well, I think it's easy if you can go to our city's website, but we are going to have virtual information meetings about the drafts that we're doing on mapping, and we'll continue to have virtual meetings as well as an opportunity for people to come online to communicate. So they can go to CLTfuture2040.com and talk about both the UDO and the mapping process that we're going through. I think that's the most important and easy way, because then you can ask any question that you want to ask and get that done. But my goal is to always think about this in the context of, let's have good information from all of our sources, particularly our neighborhoods and our residents, as well as those folks that drive the economy of development and opportunity as well.
One thing tucked away in the Unified Development Ordinance is a mandate for electric vehicle charging stations to be placed in all new parking lots and parking structures. The auto industry appears to be moving ever more quickly down the road toward electric propulsion for various different sized vehicles. And in fact, Charlotte is shifting its bus fleet to electric powered vehicles next year, in part, not completely, but that's a result of the City Council approving a pilot program on a 10-to-1 vote. But this is a pilot program, so there's still a lot to learn about how these vehicles will operate, how dependable they will be, because electric vehicles are impacted by the heat and the cold and the terrain. And the only thing that's really important about any of this is how far can they go before they need to be charged. This is obviously going to be an option for the future, but the technology continues to evolve. Does committing to 18 buses in the next year mean that, pilot program or not, this is the road we've chosen to go down?
Well, you know, last week we rolled out 5 new all-electric buses at the airport, and we have 43 electric vehicles in our fleet. I drive an electric car, and I'm going to say this weekend I had to go down to my hometown, Columbia, South Carolina, and the finding a charging station is absolutely essential to the success of this. So I ended up in the city of Columbia's parking deck at a free parking space with a free charging opportunity there to do this. And I think that that's what, if Columbia is doing it, Charlotte needs to do it 10 times more. I believe that the future of our city and clean air is electric vehicles and a better mass transit system. Those are the two things that, if you have to have a car, that it be a car that is clean, it's electric, yeah. But more importantly, that we build an electric bus system that we have in for mass transit that people can take, and also creating those opportunities with the electric vehicles is really important. So we're all in on that. It may be a pilot to test out the model, the brand, the utility, to get the appropriate number of vehicles in play for the service that we wanted to deliver. But I don't believe it's a pilot that says, well, we go back to diesel and gasoline fuel vehicles.
The no vote, it was a 10-1 vote. The no vote was from Braxton Winston, who had some concerns over the cleanliness of electric vehicles, because the cleanliness of their non-emission has to deal with where the power comes from in the first place. And this is all part of a broader goal by the city to have all city-owned vehicles and fleets run on zero carbon energy sources by 2030. Is powering them by electricity that will come by and large from Duke Energy zero carbon?
I've heard this debate, but you know, I go back to the loaf or the half loaf. We've got to start somewhere. Mike, you and I both have lived in this community when we've had cold red days in the summertime because of our geography, where we've had to tell people with asthma or children that had, you know, respiratory illnesses, stay inside. That's not the kind of city that we want to be, that we are actually harming our citizens with the air that we're having. So yes, there is a debate. And I think that when you look at this nationally, we're not at the front of the pack. We're probably pretty much progressing towards being at the top of people with the idea of 2030. But at the same time, technology and innovation is going to drive this. We're going to get to this place where we can figure out how to make the climate safe for the people that live in our communities without destroying our planet.
So Charlotte has this strategic energy action plan, which contains the goal of making Charlotte a low carbon city by 2050. Is that one of the reasons that Charlotte has just achieved LEED Gold certification, or is there something else that we're doing that has led us to that?
Absolutely. We are doing all the conversions, you know, thanks to the community and the citizens that approved the cultural arts plans that created some of the most fantastic institutions from Discovery Place on one end of the corner of this Tryon to the Gantt Center on the other end. All of those will be converted to achieve our climate change objectives in our energy plan.
When we come back, traffic and transportation and ordinances. Stay with us. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyle is our guest today on Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. Charlotte City Council spent time recently talking about its Vision Zero pledge, which calls for the elimination of traffic fatalities for both people in cars and for pedestrians. Charlotte DOT is working to try to make streets safer by installing flashing beacons at certain crosswalks and mobile digital displays to show drivers just how fast they're going. But CMPD data shows that enforcement is on the decline. CMPD's own figures show that police make dramatically fewer traffic stops than a decade ago. And as that happened, the number of fatalities increased. We're on track to meet or exceed last year's number of vehicular deaths. Why hasn't City Council directed CMPD to do more enforcement?
Well, I think that when you look at the past 2 years in COVID, you look at the workload of our public safety folks, that they have some of the most difficult opportunities to prioritize what's most important. And you know that we've been doing that. So that's one reason that we work with CMPD, so that we have a transportation group that looks at other ways besides saying we're going to write traffic tickets. What can we do that is technology-based to adjust what we do in both how we can manage traffic, how we can use technology to do that, and as well, how do we design intersections and highways, well, our thoroughfares in Charlotte, to be more safe. So you can see the effort that's being done with a lot of signage that's electronically gives you automatic feedback. If you drive almost on any street that's requested those signs that say 30, what you're going. And a lot of times, if you're like me, you drive by and you think, I'm going to slow down. But that data is actually going the speed that you were going before you started to slow down. Is being fed into a system so that we can have these kinds of records. So technology is going to help us. Design is going to help us. When you look at crosswalks and the lighting over crosswalks, that's going to help us. So what the council has asked the staff to do is to look more in depth. Can we do more and better? And enforcement is one way to do this, but it's kind of like, you know, a flash in the pan versus a continuous improvement. And I think that we want to do both, but we want the continuous improvement that modifies behavior. And that's going to be, I believe, the debate that the council will have. And it's been referred to our Safe Communities Committee to look both at technological opportunities as well as physical design opportunities to make our city safer.
You mentioned
Vision Zero has been around a long time. And I think that when we look in best practices across the country, we'll know more about how to grade ourselves on what we're doing and make those changes.
You mentioned priorities. I know the city has set a priority for reducing violent crime, the use of guns in neighborhoods, et cetera. CMPD is focusing on reducing violent crime, but the number of people killed by homicide, I think in the last year, is approaching 72 or thereabouts. The number of people killed in traffic accidents is 65. That's really close.
It is very close.
Should that be a higher priority?
Well, I think that when you look at what we're trying to do in terms of homicides, where that kind of has a ripple effect for so many things, the traffic is a comparable situation. One of my neighbors was hit by a car and injured in a really difficult way. They had a bedroom upstairs. They're no longer able to do that. It's both, you know, you don't choose and say one is more than the other. You try to work on both.
Okay. Since the last time we spoke, the Charlotte streetcar is up and running, although ridership figures have been disappointing. And I think that ridership on the CATS bus system and the Lynx Blue Line is also down from previous years. Does that concern you?
Well, I think what concerns me is when are we going to get COVID managed, and when will businesses begin to populate the routes along both the Gold Line and the Blue Line? That's what I think is going to be of an impact. I think that people are going to look for safe ways to get into work. They're going to determine how the new work will be done. The Alliance had a meeting last week where they actually talked about models that companies are using to get people back into the office. Many of our companies are looking at that in a way that is create stability for the workforce, because that's what people want. They want to know, but I believe the future of work is going to change, and we will still need the ability to move people around the city, but it will be different than, you know, the regular commute that I think we'll see traffic utilization of, or the maybe 15 or 10 to 12 hours of the day, instead of it being the peak hours of, you know, 7 till 9 and 4 until 6. I think there's going to be a lot of adjustments that have to be made. And that's one reason that this infrastructure plan goes at the federal level, our Vision Zero plan at the local level, all of these things mesh together. And hopefully at some point we'll get that where COVID allows us to say, now we have a solution to this virus that is vaccinations or testing, that we will get to a place that we begin to integrate these plans. And I think that's what will work.
And of course, the other plan is the transit plan, which has a lot of dollar figures attached to it. It expands the the blue line. It creates a line from, I think, Matthews and Mint Hill to Belmont. If money can be found, and the only way to get this really the full buy-in of everybody in Mecklenburg County is to find money for a rail line to Huntersville, Davidson, and Cornelius. Even if all those things can happen, how do you get people to ride it?
Well, you look at the option. You know, if you take I-77 now, it's different than when we were pre-COVID. What will it look like post-COVID? I-77 from the north to the south is a long way. But I think there's a factor that people have forgotten about. Look at where our major employment center is in Ballantyne. And if you are trying to attract workforce talent, and your talent is young and millennial, and they're coming to Charlotte and they want to live in South End, or I think it's called South Mo now, or the southern part, and you want to get to Ballantyne, you're not going to want to buy a car. And so these are the trends that we've thought about so much before, prior to COVID, that we're just struggling to get to a place that we find out what that's going to mean now. So I would hope that we actually look at the locations where people want to live, but also building our workforce talent. Centene is going to hire 3,000 people, and they're going to have an electric bus route from the end of the blue line to their office building. That's 3,000 opportunities for people to work there and have access to bus and rail. So let's not forget our ability to attract the top talent for the companies that are coming here require us to have a transportation plan that works for their employees.
This is a silly question, but when's the last time you or any member of council rode the bus or the links?
It's been a while since I've ridden the bus, actually, to tell you the truth. I'm trying to get my money out of my electric car.
Earlier this year, the city passed an LGBTQ non-discrimination ordinance. Originally, it was going to apply to the city and also companies with 14 or more employees. But then it became everybody, all employers. And now Mecklenburg County has passed its own ordinance covering all employers. How does the county's ordinance differ from Charlotte's? And within the city limits, which ordinance takes precedence?
I really think they're materially the same. I don't know that, I think that, you know, originally Mecklenburg County had a resolution, which was really a supportive effort to say, this is what we believe is right. This is what we believe in, that dignity and respect conversation that they had. And then they codify that into an ordinance. And the ordinance, and I believe, are materially the same. It's just that when if someone experiences this problem and wants to file a complaint, and you're in the unincorporated area, you would do that under the county's ordinance. Inside the city limits, you do it under the city's ordinance.
Some people have obviously, because they're on a different end of the political spectrum, have questioned the need for these ordinances. And then along comes North Carolina Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, who appeared in the video this week, in which he refers to LGBTQ community as filth. He's standing by those comments. He's doubling down on those comments by pointing out books that are being used in schools that he opposes. And that has led to a chorus of individuals demanding that he resign. Are you among those voices?
You know, Mike, I was raised in a house of worship, and I just can't even imagine someone standing in a pulpit and calling people filth. If there's anything that I have learned from my years on this planet, is that everybody deserves dignity and respect. And I don't have to make a statement about what someone like the lieutenant governor says. I have to live the values of this city. And you know, our values are welcoming, diversity and inclusion. Filth does not come, a word like filth, just think about what that really means and how disparaging that is to anyone. So I don't need to weigh in. What I need to know is that this community.
But as a leader, should you not weigh in?
I don't think I have to weigh in. As mayor, the values of this community and a unified, a unanimous vote for a non-discrimination ordinance for LGBTQ people, that speaks for itself. I understand sometimes people go on social media and they want to make those statements, but for me, I'm going to live our values as mayor, and I'm going to live my values as Vylyles.
His comments fall in line with Republican thinking in a lot of different quarters. He said what's happening in schools is, quote, flat out child abuse. He alleges when they get there to schools, what do we teach them? Teach them a bunch of stuff about how to hate America. Teach them a bunch of stuff about why they are racist. Teach them a bunch of stuff about transgenderism and homosexuality. That's a quote. In that one sentence, he refers to the bogus claim being made by Republicans about how critical race theory is being taught in schools. It is not. He alleges that learning about the nation's faults equates to teaching children how to hate the country. That is not what is happening there. And State Senator Jeff Jackson has called his comments about LGBTQ people open discrimination and completely unacceptable. And he has asked, among others, for the lieutenant governor to resign. If you're not going to take a stand, should city council?
I don't know. The council members would have to make that decision, but I would hope that voters pay attention. He's going to run for, I'm sure, re-election based upon his platform. And I would hope that this city and this state would recognize the harm that he does to individuals and making these statements.
We are living at a time when democracy is under attack and when it's being led by the Republican Party. I'm going to just say it because it's true. Should you not, as a mayor, say something to point this out?
You know, Mike, I want to ask you, you have a great platform on this show. And I think that you have made statements that help people understand better. I hope my statements also do that and reflect that opportunity to better understand what my role is as an elected official and how I weigh the impact of actions that are taken. I have a lot of respect for the ability for this community to see what's right and what's wrong. That's how I see it.
Okay. We'll close on an up note. And that is that the annual list of the world's best cities was just released. And lo and behold, Charlotte is on it. We're 99th out of 100, but we made it. 99th out of 100 of the world's best global urban destinations. Do you know why we made it? And do you know what, if anything, this means to Charlotte?
You know, we get a lot of surveys and opportunities to be ranked in some way. And my understanding is that we were ranked the way we were because we're a global banking powerhouse, second to New York City. That we also ranked in terms of Fortune 500 companies coming to Charlotte. And that was an important consideration. And our airport continues to help us drive a lot of this opportunity for people to become global. So yes, I think that those were the major factors, but I don't think it hurts to be a town where you can go to the NASCAR Hall of Fame, drive a car around a big track in our community, to have the sports center and entertainment opportunities we have. And I think that Southern charm is just who we are. Our hospitality makes us unique.
Charlotte Mayor Vylyles, thank you for the hour. We appreciate it. More questions, but we'll have to wait till a later date. Thanks. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.